The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the network, producers, advertisers, or hosts, and belong solely to those who make them. Truth Frequency is a non-biased and non-partisan platform committed to presenting all aspects of the truth and allowing you, the listener, to decide for yourself.
31 seconds, and we're gone for auto-sequence start.
This is David Icke, and you're tapped into the Truth Frequency.
It's hard to tell people to regain their faith in humanity, to forgive the anger that you have for these people that have trespassed on you, and to just start seeking the new existence. But we have to. That's what we have to do. We're the voice now.
It's called being in the zone. It's called, you know, being lucky. It's called having everything go your way.
When you deal with computers, you deal with ones and zeros. And the only way that you can make a computer more powerful is to expand the consciousness of the computer.
Well, it's something bigger than ourselves, and that's got to be said.
That has to do with the self-image that people have.
You know, just kind of your ego being swept aside or being kind of stomped on or being swatted like a fly.
People are waking up to that en masse in such an incredible way, and it's something that I guess when we're involved in this, we maybe lose the forest for the trees, but it really is and truly happening at a societal level.
It is being able to take what feels like ordinary human energy and mastering extraordinary power, even with a single person in a society with this kind of power. We call it the X Factor.
The universe is not only stranger than you imagine, the universe is stranger than you can imagine.
And guess what, guys? Here we are.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, once again, all tapped into this truth frequency here on Oracle Broadcasting. And this is your host, Chris Geo. And joining me, as always, is my lovely chipmunk and co-host, Cherie.
Hey, everybody.
And it is December 11th, 2010. We have a great show planned for you. Joining us once again is the legend himself, Michael Tesarian. He is an alternative historian, lecturer, author, and filmmaker. We're going to discuss Architects of Control, which is his mind control DVD, and then talk about his upcoming film, The Meta Child. And hopefully we didn't get the time zones mixed up, because I know last time we got him a little bit mixed up. He was a little bit late, but we'll see what happens. So how is everything with you, Cherie?
Doing pretty good. Pretty good.
We've had an incredible week, haven't we?
Yeah. It's been a good week.
It has been a great week. We took some time off. We watched Dexter. I don't know if anybody's seen that series, that Showtime series, but my God, we just got hooked and started watching episode after episode after episode. So it was nice to just disconnect from everything and take a big step back, because we have to do that. We have to take a big step back every once in a while, because when you let this kind of stuff consume you, then you start to go to this really negative place when you're constantly researching all this negativity and the eugenics and everything that goes on in the world, mind control and just glued to the computer. It's, I think, just as detrimental as being glued to the television.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it can be more so devastating, because you're interacting with it and getting sucked into the internet realm, and eventually you forget that what is going on the computer is actually not going on in real life. And it's real easy to distance yourself from friends, family, your job, things that you have to do in everyday life when you're on the computer 24/7. And so we're happy to get out of the internet realm for a week or so, and it was good for us.
Yeah. Turn the computer off, go outside, ladies. Not right now, after the show. Turn the computer off, go outside, and just enjoy yourself, because you have to enjoy life, enjoy the sunshine, enjoy everything that's out there.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Looks like we're going to be coming up to a break here in a second, and we should be back with Michael Tesarian if we didn't get the time zones mixed up. I'm afraid we did, though. I told him Sunday, 6 a.m., because I thought he was 10 hours ahead. And he turns out to be in Seattle this time. So we'll see. We'll be back on the other side, truthfrequencyradio.com. Hey, this is Chris and Cherie, hosts of Truth Frequency, here to tell you all about our favorite suppliers of entheogens and sacred plants, Bouncing Bear Botanicals. This is the only supplier that I trust for fresh ayahuasca vine directly from the Amazon basin. Just go to truthfrequencyradio.com and click on the banner right on our front page.
And don't forget, Chris, Bouncing Bear also offers only the freshest Amanita muscaria, San Pedro cactus, Salvia divinorum, Thai kratom, and much, much more. So order now through our website, truthfrequencyradio.com, by clicking on the banner. Your order will be shipped securely, and your information is always kept safe and confidential. And by ordering through truthfrequencyradio.com, not only will you get the best customer service on the planet, but you'll also be supporting the show.
So don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, tap into the Truth Frequency every Saturdays, 10 o'clock Central on Oracle Broadcasting, truthfrequencyradio.com. And we are back. TruthFrequencyRadio.com is the website, and we're still waiting for Michael Tesorian. So while we do that, let's go into a little bit of MK Ultra information. You know, I have to apologize, ladies and gentlemen. I think I made a mistake in the communication with him. Last time we had him on the show, he was 10 hours ahead of Pacific time. And so when I pitched him the show and he confirmed for Sunday at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is 10 hours ahead, or 8 o'clock in the morning, whatever time it is. And I found out he's in Seattle. And so he might think that it's Sunday, 8 to 10. But it's okay. We'll reschedule with him. He's one of our favorite guests. So, Cherie, why don't you take us away on a little bit of MKUltra stuff, and let's just see where the show goes.
Okay, sure. This is kind of last minute. So I want to start off by saying that there's a lot of disinformation out there about MKUltra and other mind control experiments. Mind control, actually brainwashing, was actually started by the Chinese. They came up with the term, they came up with the entire method of how to brainwash soldiers from other people's armies to create Manchurian candidate types. And we brought the Nazis over here through Operation Paperclip in 1946. And these were, you know, really horrible people. Some of them were good scientists, you know, rocket scientists, you know, and fusion type of activity, you know, just creating bombs or, you know, rockets for space flight. However, a lot of them were people that tortured people in concentration camps during World War II. And they were brought over here, and supposedly so the Soviets didn't get them. And so they took on the mentality of, oh, well, they're going to be working somewhere. They might as well be working for us, and which is a horrible, horrible thing. But they were considered so vital to the Cold War effort that they were brought into the U.S. and Canada. And a 1999 report to the Senate and the House said that between 1945 and 1955, 765 scientists, engineers, and technicians were brought to the U.S. under Paperclip and similar programs. And according to the CIA's fact book, the National Security Council and the CIA were established under the provisions of the National Security Act of 1947. In December 1947, the NSC held its first meeting. James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense, pushed for the CIA to begin a secret war against the Soviets. See, all of this is just pretty much a cover. There really was no Cold War, I don't think. It was more like a free-for-all where they decided to control the population not through, control the first world population, not through, you know, food rations or through warfare, but they were like, okay, well, if we're going to have peace, at least we can control the population while we have peace. And thus, you have all of the mind control techniques that you see on TV, in the movies, through the music. And this is how they found out how to use all these techniques. And what's interesting is that they used to have to use large amounts of drugs, torture, hypnosis, etc., to get people in a hypnotic trance-like state to where they could be brainwashed into whatever the controllers wanted them to be. But because of all of these efforts throughout the 50s and 60s, even into the 70s, they are now able to control the population just through the use of propaganda placement, subliminal programming, and harmonics in music. It's really insane. Me and Chris went to a pizza place the other day, and oh man, we shouldn't have, but I went to a pizza place the other day, and there's these girls walking by, and there was just the most annoying pop music in the background. I don't even remember what. Oh, it was something like a B.
It was Lady Gaga. It was Lady Gaga. Some other stuff going on in the background. And they were walking around like zombies, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it was sickening, and they were just mouthing the words, walking like zombies with this blank look on their face.
Like a B6 or something like that. It was just, I and then another one walked by doing the exact same thing, except this one was like 11. The other one was like 16. This one was like 11 or 10 years old. And I was like, whoa, that's weird. You know, once I can understand, you know, some girls are like that when they're that age, but a 10-year-old walking past singing Lady Gaga, but not even singing it. She was like in some kind of hypnosis or something and just kind of mumbling the words, blank stare on her face. And I'm like, who are you talking to? You know, and it just blew me away. But they said in the church committee hearings of 1977 that this whole mind control stuff, all the experiments ended in, you know, in the 70s or in the late 60s. Oh, it's not going on anymore, but really it was. It's been going on up until now. And what I suspect is that a lot of the techniques that they used on MKUltra victims are already being used, you know, widespread. Whenever your mom gets depressed and goes to her doctor and the doctor gives her antidepressants, she's basically an MKUltra victim right off the bat. When they give you these psychopharmaceuticals, they are labeling you. They are brainwashing you. And they are controlling you. And eventually, after, it may not happen the next day, but within a few months or within a few years, that person's going to actually start acting insane, even if they weren't insane before, because these medications, these techniques have been used for so long that they have gotten very, very good at hiding the deaths, at hiding all the side effects, or sweeping them under the rug, or basically paying off people to be okay with all of this. It's been so long. It's been 50 years since they started doing all this.
Mm-hmm.
So, we still, on a grand scale, most people in the United States don't even know what MKUltra is. So you have to understand, I know a lot of people out there that are in the chat or, you know, whatever, they're like, oh, this is old news, I don't want to hear about this. Yeah, but your mom doesn't know. Your right. grandma doesn't know.
Right.
And
you know, the chat people represent maybe 5% of our listeners, 2% of our listeners. You know, so we can't really base it on just what the people on the chat say. But we do have a caller from Minnesota. We'll get to you right after the break because we're going to be coming up to a break here in about 2 minutes.
Yeah, we want to.
But there's many, many different levels of mind control, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it goes to from as simple as just sitting down in front of the television and that hypnotic state that you get in while you're watching. And after about 15 to 18 minutes of watching television, you start to get in this trance-like state. And then you become subjective to all of the things that they're firing out at you. And that's why when you watch CNN and things like that, you've got about 6-8 different things going on the screen. It's because they know your conscious brain can't pick all that up. But once they get you in that trance-like state, your subconscious starts to pick it up.
Yeah, and then if you just add on the New Freedom Initiative and things like that, the New Freedom Initiative was put into practice back I think it was like 5 years ago, by W. Bush. And basically it says that you have to let your child, if your child goes to a public school, your child has to have a psychological evaluation. And then if they determine from that psych eval that your child needs, say, Ritalin or won't shut up during class, then they're going to forcibly medicate your child. And if you try to fight back, then eventually they'll try to get CPS involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very serious to me, because a child's brain is developing rapidly during that period. And they're trying to put 2- and 3-year-olds on these medications. And when they do that, basically your child is an MKUltra victim. I'm sorry. I can't see it any other way, because I've seen it so much that it doesn't really matter to me whether you were tortured or not, or whether you were, you know, sensory deprived or not, or whether you were locked up or not. We're all basically victims of this by now. All of us have at one point or another either known somebody that was on these types of medications, or known someone who was locked up for being quote unquote crazy, or known someone who has had a problem with depression or anxiety or whatever. We're all a part of this now. It's not something that is just locked away in Branson, Missouri anymore. It's something that's on your front doorstep. Whenever you hear about a kid killing themselves, 9 times out of 10, they were probably on an antidepressant or some other psychopharmaceutical drug.
Well, yeah, absolutely. When you look at the kids from, what was that school?
Columbine.
Yeah, they were all on antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these side effects even say may cause depression and suicidal thoughts. I mean, how are you going to take a medication which is supposed to cure depression with side effects that say may cause depression and suicidal thoughts? And consult your doctor if that happens.
Yeah, I know. That's insane.
It is.
I mean, that's the definition of insanity, is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And that's what people are doing en masse. I don't know. I think that it has to do with responsibility for your own life. And Michael Tesarian talks about how we have basically killed our sense of self by the time we're 15 years old. Where we don't have a sense of self anymore, because we have killed it, because we want to be like everybody else. We want to be, quote unquote, normal. And normal, in my opinion, I look around and I see normal and it is messed up. I don't like normal. If I were normal, I wouldn't feel like I was a real person, because normal right now is muttering Lady Gaga while you're in a pizza place and not knowing who you are or what you are or where you are. That's not normal for me. I would really like us to go back to the old days, whenever nobody was on drugs and everybody was happy without them, and the worst drug that was around was maybe heroin, and you never even heard of anybody using it. I really wish we could go back to that, because things were so much calmer back then, and so much simpler. But they have gotten so good at using our music against us, using our newspapers, our magazines, our TV against us, to the point where we don't even think on our own anymore. There is no self. There is only the collective. And so I encourage everybody to get out of the collective, because that's not somewhere I want to be, and I'm sure it's not where y'all want to be either.
No, I completely agree with you. We're starting to realize that sane is insane, and insane is sane, and up is down, left is right, white is black, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a brave new world.
It is a brave new world, absolutely. Let's go to Kevin from Minnesota. Looks like we skipped that last break. So, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Kevin.
Sorry about that. You threw me off there. I wasn't quite prepared. I called a couple weeks ago, and I'm the vet that's living with Gulf War illness. And in my research of Gulf War illness, I've came across MK Ultra. And the one thing that I've always concluded from it and from the documentation not only does it say mind control, but it also states behavior modification.
Oh.
And this system of what they've set up is put before us in every facet of our life, from our cereal boxes to our soda cans, not my soda cans, but soda cans, product placement within movies and television, to the newspaper. They have been doing this for many, many years to make us proper sheeple to follow along the corral, whether it's to the far, far left or the far, far right, to keep us heading in the direction of where they want us to go. From the earliest known psychological ops, from HGL's War of the Worlds, how that was used as a means of a test to see how the people would react to the possibility of revealing of aliens, all the way up to today with certain pixels on your television screen that in a combination of pixels before your eyes can actually go into your synapses and program you for what they want to occur.
That's right. I'm glad you called back, because that's exactly what I was trying to get across to people. They don't understand that everything you look at, everything you touch in your day-to-day life is connected to this huge propaganda campaign, whether it's wanting people to go to war, like we did in Iraq, or wanting people to hate 9/11 truthers, or wanting people to buy iPods, or iPhones. It's something that is, like Michael Tesarian says, it's ubiquitous. Mind control is ubiquitous. It's not a question of who is mind controlled, it's a question of who's not mind controlled.
Oh, guess who's buzzing in?
Oh, great. He's coming.
Excellent, excellent. So let me do this. I'll go ahead and keep it going, and I'll add him to the
cool.
call here.
Cool. Yeah. Go ahead.
And one thing I was going to add, just as far as, you go back and you hear about the whole Coke bottles or the little flashes in the movies, 30 years ago, where it's like purchase Coke or buy more popcorn and stuff. And they've proven how these attempts have worked. And even now that through the frequencies of our music, with, if they want to call it backward masking or even subliminal there, an example is during the movie The Exorcist, the creators of The Exorcist actually put humming of bees in the background on such a low frequency that we could barely hear it, yet it made us squirmish and added to the horror of the movie Exorcist. But
yeah, because people are afraid of bees.
Right.
Wow.
So it is everywhere. If you do a search on subcommittee, Department of Defense subcommittee of 1977, I'm pulling this out of the
I've got
top
it,
of my
I've head. Got it right here, actually. It's the, let's
Department
see.
Of Defense?
No, actually, this one was Select Committee on U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and Subcommittee on Health and Scientific Research of the Committee on Human Resources.
Right. There's another one that's kind of a sister to that book or whatever related. It's called Department of Defense Behavior Modification Involving Human Subjects, which is a really good one that even dives into more so of what they're doing, and they're continuing to do this today because we are the sheeple, and we are so easily unaware of what is going on. And like you said, the more people that realize what they're doing to try to control us, the easier it is not to be controlled. And thank you guys so much for coming to Oracle, and I can't wait to hear Michael Tesarian and thank him for me for all the work he's done.
We will, Kevin. Thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Looks like we have about a minute and a half before we come up to the break, and we're going to bring Michael on as soon as we get back. Anything you want to say to wrap it up?
Well, I just want to say I'm glad he called in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, so. Absolutely. It's always a great, great interview with Michael. And we have some great guests coming up in the near future. We don't announce the guests anymore because we want to just surprise everybody and make sure everybody's tuning in every single broadcast. And let me just take this opportunity to thank the guys over at Oracle, all the AM and FM affiliates out there, all the great listeners. The show's really just skyrocketed in the past year, and I'm just really honored to be a part of it.
Same here, absolutely. So, well, when Michael comes on, we're going to get into some of this MK Ultra stuff, his theories about mind control and how prevalent it is in our society today, and then we're going to be talking about his new work, Meta Child.
Yes.
Which sounds very, very interesting. I've read up about it, so. When we come back from the break, I guess we'll get into that.
Excellent. TruthFrequencyRadio.com. We'll see you on the other side. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. TruthFrequencyRadio.com is our website. And joining us on the line is alternative historian and author Michael Tesarian. He is an expert on the occult history of Ireland and America. Born in Ireland, he's researched the mythologies of the world as well as his own country's magnificent and mysterious druidic history. Michael is just a wealth of information with in-depth research including Atlantis, ancient astronauts, the occult, Irish origins of civilization, mind control, and the Meta Child. Thank you very much for coming on, Michael.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be back. Hi, Sherry. How's it going?
Hey, doing great.
You know, I have to say, last year you came on the broadcast, we had 50, 60 listeners, something like that, and you so humbly appeared. And now, over the course of the last year, we've skyrocketed to tens of thousands of listeners worldwide, AM and FM. We're on the AM and FM dials, and I can't help but feel that you played a key role in our success, in the success of the show. So I just want to thank you personally for that, Michael.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and you certainly deserve it, of course. You know, and again, my preference is always to come on shows like yours. You know, it's very important that the world hears it in this way, as opposed to going on the mainstream, which I have a personal dislike of. So it's far better to have people who know what they're doing or passionate about what they're interested in actually do the homework and study, rather than just some script that they've been handed by, you know, an anonymous source.
Oh, absolutely.
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 Yeah.
You know, last time we discussed Architects of Control, but over the course of the last year, I've realized how important mind control is and what role it plays in our society. And I want to get into the Meta Child a bit later in the broadcast, but right now, I want to ask you about a comment from Architects of Control. You read a quote by Jim Keith, and then you said, "It's now become a question of who is not mind controlled, but rather who is mind controlled." And I guess that's the big question right there. How can we tell who is mind controlled and who is not?
Well, we got to take it as a given that almost all of us are at some level mind-controlled when you understand that mind control starts with a form of auto-hypnosis. The mind control that, you know, we addressed, or normally we address in public, tends to be only one kind of mind control. That's because it's of the most interest, it is the most bizarre, it has the most sort of sinister connotations when you're talking about Big Brother and maybe that kind of Orwellian mind control. And of course, we've gone to great lengths to show that it does exist, it has been happening, there is evidence, and so on. However, when you really get into mind control in a more broader context, you start to realize that you couldn't have those other kinds of mind control without this auto-hypnosis. I've talked about it briefly, I mean really briefly, in other projects. I talked about it this year in June, a conspiracy con. I tried to address it there. I went into it a little bit more in this age of manipulation talk I did in Europe, but I haven't been able to get into it in as much detail as I would like. So I'm glad you asked this question. Basically, the kind of mind, what I think is the most important thing for people to grasp, is that mind control would not work. It's not some sort of wizardry, you know, in this sort of Svengali way, or some sort of Star Trek way in which a beam hits you, or the sorcerers are there hypnotizing you will obey me, you know, this kind of thing. That is only one small, sort of almost Hollywoodish rendering of mind control. And then even when you hear about the famous MK Ultra, I'm sure you all know about that, and I've had many guests on speaking about that. It's fascinating.
Oh yeah,
that again is one kind of mind control. But what interests me much greater than that is this capacity of human beings to auto-hypnotize themselves and adopt belief systems that are irrational. We can argue what they are. Some people would say that's religious beliefs. Others would say, no, it's the idea of collectivism. You know, there's a whole range of what constitutes these levels of auto-hypnotism. That's a huge subject, and that's what fascinates me. But what my real point was is that the sorcerers that we address, or that I address in my work, are master psychologists. And they themselves first began to understand that this kind of hypnosis that they're into will work on the human race, because they'd already studied what I'm talking about. They realized that the human being naturally auto-hypnotizes themselves. And therefore, they just simply said that we know that our systems will work because there's a natural function and natural ability for human beings to go into altered states of reality, to not face reality as it really is. They already do this. They already do this without even knowing it. So all we have to do is take the basic premise of this, that people are dead scared of reality, don't really face it. They have ideas of reality, and work with that. And of course, this is quite well known now to people who study this matter. And therefore, the people who are at the very top of the pyramid started to fund the Chicago Institute, the Tavistock Institute, the SRI, the Hoover Institute, the MK Ultras, the Dr. Delgados, all the Dr. Campbells, all these extremely sinister creatures who are, again, lower henchmen. They're just merely to devise the tools to sort of streamline the idea so that they could do it to masses if need be. But it was all based on the idea of just basic human psychology. You know, based on how the mind works, based on the anatomy of consciousness, based on this, which is what I addressed in the Conspiracy Con talk, and you know, utter directed. We want to live in the persona. Our ideas of who we are, when we even use words like the self, very, very abused words, I might add, like self, these words have become invisible by use. We hardly even know what we mean when we say the word self. It's such a deep and a meaningful word. When people use the word I without even really understanding its philosophical depth. So we have sacrificed the I, we've sacrificed the self in order to live in a world in which the pseudo-self exists, which some people would call the ego, and we can argue whether that's a true definition or not. But for just terminology's sake, we live in this pseudo-self, pseudo-persona, pseudo-ego, and that ego is entirely based on relationships that we have with other people. It's like one mirror reflecting another mirror. This is what we have when we're walking around in society. It's like the famous Jungian mask in which we all play this game, and our sense of self is based on how we relate to our parents, our siblings, certainly our schoolmasters, how we relate to the world in general. This is the play of masks, and it has very little to do with the actual self that exists within ourselves, the real self of a person, which is a pretty much an invisible thing pushed into the recess of consciousness, hardly dealt with at all. In fact, if you even try to express it, as we all know, what will happen in society? You'll be marginalized, alienated, told that this behavior is not allowable. You must go along to get along and all the rest of it. So the controllers have noticed this. They've arranged society, and they understand that this magnetism that pulls us outward from our own inner being, out into the play of masks, into the world, works wonders for them, because then they know we don't think as individuals. We don't have a spirit of rebellion. We have a social conscience. And I'm not ruling these things out. I'm not saying they're wrong, but it's been taken too far. And so this is where the hive mind, this is where the collective consciousness, this is where the consensus trance enters in. And then you only have to find the sort of circuitry of that to be able to control masses of people. We know, for instance, that when you sit down with anyone over dinner, a weekend, a couple of beers, most people will actually start agreeing with you if you start bringing up things about world controllers, the world sucks, things shouldn't be this way, wars are terrible, the government sucks. Most people will sit there and sort of pretend that they do in fact agree with you and work, you know, you get this impression that, yeah, we see eye to eye. But as a matter of fact, then these people get up from the table, walk away, and then, you know, don't want to do anything about it. Why? Because they're under a form of mind control, their own mind control. What can little old me do about the octopus of the World Bank, the IMF, the Euro, the economic community and the people who run that? What can little old me do to stop a war or change reality or fix things or help my country or bring enlightenment to the world? You see, so we all have this very self-sadistic, masochistic understanding, yet we might verbally go through the motions of saying, yes, I understand that this is a negative thing. Oh, I just wish things were different. But let Alex Jones deal with it because I haven't got a clue how to deal with this. You know, and I just want to go back and play with my toys and go to work and sit in that cubicle and I hope it'll all go away. You know, this is one example of this relationship between the controllers hoping that your own littleness, your own incapacity, your own self-sadism and masochism will work for them without them even having to, you know, get up from their desks. It's all a system of programmed auto control.
Well, it makes it even easier for them if you consider the fact that most people don't really reach maturity emotionally. So they're still like a 6-year-old who still believes in Santa Claus and whose world would be completely devastated if you showed them proof that there wasn't a Santa Claus. So they're basically living their lives tricking themselves into thinking everything is the way it is because that's the way it is and there's nothing I can do to change it. And
Well, people don't even get a chance to go through an emotional puberty because they're putting them on these psychopharmaceuticals earlier and earlier and earlier, and you don't get to feel your emotions or understand them.
That's right. And it also turns out that when people have to make a choice in life, rather than choose to free themselves from slavery in a really authentic way, they'd much prefer to take Big Brother's carrot to become a mini dictator or a petty dictator over others. Said, I won't fight the system, I'll join them. And so the merest chance, and this goes for Freemasons, and it goes for the police chiefs, and it goes for these so-called politicians that are big legends in their own minds, but actually wield very little power. Most of the people that we visually see, that we imagine to be in power, have done that. Realizing on some level that to walk the Siddhartha road is all nigh impossible, realizing that to fight the system is, again, nigh on impossible, they then say, give me a few stripes. Give me a uniform, and I will serve you. You know, so there's also this, which is don't balk the system, and
it's instilled from the beginning. Let me hold that thought, Michael. We're going to take a quick break. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, TruthFrequencyRadio.com. We are speaking with the legend himself, Michael Tsarian. Now, before the break, we were speaking about the quote-unquote ego or the fake ego that's been implanted in us, and I totally agree. I mean, from the beginning, we're told that boys are supposed to play with guns, girls are supposed to wear dresses, we're supposed to go to school, be on the football team or the cheerleader team, and get a scholarship, go to college, get a good job with a corporation, retire at 60. Our whole life is planned out, and our whole image is planned out before we're even born. But how do we find that lost sense of self, Michael, with all of this mind control? And how do we get comfortable with the true self?
Well, it's I went into this in various... I've really belabored that point, and I almost make it a recurrent motif. And it has to do with a thing called apophatic learning, which is more simply stated as simply negation. The self is not something that you can come upon directly. All the psychologists agree on this point, especially Jung and Freud and the head honchos who really look deeply into the psyche. Of course, they weren't the first. Most of what we know to be psychology today is rooted very much in the philosophy of both the modern and the ancient times, or let's even say just going back to the time of Plato. And all these experts really understood one basic fact, and that is that the mind has this critical apparatus, this judgment capability, which of course is being turned right off today. There's a reason for that. And they understood that this comes under the heading of the reason. But the reason works in two ways. One way is, of course, to discover, to analyze, and so on. But one of its other techniques, and it's very, very important in psychology and psychoanalysis, ultimately in spirituality, is to deconstruct, to discover what something is not. And this often helps a lot because some of the most elusive mysteries are not, you're not able to apprehend them directly. You can only apprehend them by negation as to finding out what they're not. This is, again, as I said before, very, very important in psychology when it comes to introversion, soul-searching, and trying, as you say, to determine what makes you different than everybody else as opposed to the same. I never rule out that we have certain things in common. We do, and in daily life, we should have interactions with other people. We need those. But what my bugbear is that we have used this normal level of extroversion and interest in other people's life, and what I refer to as the entanglement factor in other people's lives. We've used this normal sort of phenomena to lose ourself. We've made it worse than it is. We have what William Blake, the great poet, called mind-forged manacles. We've actually imprisoned ourselves in the light. We've lost ourselves in the world of other people, in our social duties and domestic duties and obligations, and we are sort of hiding out. And therefore, that's why all of the stimuli of our world exists. Again, the world controllers monopolize on this because they've realized that, yet again, by studying human consciousness, the brain and the senses can only take in a certain amount of stimuli. But then if you overstimulate, they know that people like stimuli, it's normal, it's natural, but if you overstimulate, then they know that the mind will shut down just by having a surplus of everything, far too much to concentrate on, too many chic groups, too many cliques, too many opinions. And then it becomes this chaos of voices, this big parliament of opinions and voices in which the reason cannot operate, can't come to a true decision. Because for every decision you make, somebody else can rebut it, you know. And we have then this constant back and forth until the mind itself becomes exhausted. And therefore, that's what they're hoping. They hope that we'll have this existential fatigue where questions like, who am I, where am I going, what am I doing here, may never arise in a person's entire life. And even when these kinds of, because remember, the soul doesn't stay quiet. The soul always knocks on the door and tries to get in. So what will happen is people will find that tension, that stress. In fact, that's what most of the world is calling stress today. It's not so much what they think. They think it's connected to work. But if you actually compare the work that people are doing today to work that people had to do 200 years ago, we are doing hardly any actual physical labor at all in the places of work. So that can hardly be the reason for stress and hardly the reason for being tired and fatigued. Our forefathers worked unbelievably much harder than we did and had infinitely more stresses on them. They ate worse than we did. So, you know, their bodies were more malnutrited and so on. And we can see this in the third world. So that could not be the origin of stress. What it's the origin of some stress. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But the real existential stress is caused, as I once mentioned on my Art Cider series, is stress caused by living the inauthentic life. And unfortunately, the soul does not remain quiet. As Sigmund Freud pointed out, the more you repress something, the more it's liable to come back in an unhealthy way. So the calling of the soul, the call of self, is continually there. In fact, I'd say even in this era, what I'm saying has to be very much understood because it's coming back in a much more powerful way on a spiritual level than ever before. It's really calling. So then we have what is the tension between the world that we have adopted, the world that we know and we're familiar with, which is the world of the lie. And then we have this irritating thorn in our sides, which is the call of selfhood, the call of, to come back to, you know, 0 degrees latitude, 0 degrees longitude of our own psyche. And so this causes an internal conflict that then manifests itself in the multiplicity of ways, eating disorders, insomnia, neuroses, hostility, aggression, further involvement in the minutiae of the world, etc., etc., etc. And then the world controllers have made sure, as I said, that they've so overstimulated our mind, given us so many toys to play with, so many fake causes to be involved in, so many traumatic things through the television and through the news, horror stories and whatever, that we're also traumatized. So the question of who we are and the self and how to use the reason to discover these things, to engage in this very much actually beautiful, sacred process of deconstruction, a scientific, if you will, a meta-scientific process of analysis of the self, meditation, deconstruction. I don't have an A to Z on it. I always recommend that people, you know, do whatever they feel like will help in this process. But people don't even get to the starting line because the world has so taken over their consciousness. Everything they think about, the Conspiracy Con or one of those other talks, I can't remember which one it was, we did a test with the audience. I said, you know, think of, when you go into your mind of a day, just take a 24-hour period and observe, just simply observe. Don't analyze it, don't criticize it. Just observe how much other people take up your thinking, how much you're actually just thinking about other people. I don't care who it is. But how much your own consciousness is dominated with other people. And then when somebody like me comes along, or somebody like Ayn Rand comes along with a philosophy saying, you know, for goodness sake, think of yourself. Do you have a self to think about? Can you actually understand why you're here? People are like railing and saying, what are you talking about? You're talking about supreme egoism. Yet they will, their whole consciousness is filled up with their lives and the behavior and the back and forth and the conflicts and the drama that involves every other person, leaving no room for the self. And then when you advocate this thing about, you know, maybe come back to selfhood and think about your own needs, people think you're talking heresy, because that is exactly what has happened. People think that when you're talking in this way, you are absolutely, you know, to be shouted down, and that you're a supreme egoist and all of these kinds of things, just to merely advocate that somebody know thyself, which were the wisest words ever written on this planet at any and other time, words that are so precious you wouldn't need a single holy book if you understood the meaning of those words and the call of what they mean. Those words are the root of all religion, all spirituality, all politics, all understanding. Know thyself. When somebody understands the meaning of those just two words, that is the only religion that is required, the only yoga, the only bedrock philosophy that is required. Everything else is built upon that. No more sacred words have been written. And yet, if you really look at it today, there is absolute antithesis of that. The New Age movement is riddled with collectivism. The we, the us and the our is one of the ways that I always define it. And the educational system, the television, there's an enormous focus on the consensus, the hive mentality, the crowd, the opinion polls, everybody just parroting what everybody else says. So I have always made this a very dominant theme in my work, that unless, because I talk about the war on consciousness, there's no solution to any of the mishaps in our world, no permanent solutions anyway, until people stop this ubiquitous collectivism and tone it down and start understanding what their own needs are, what their own purpose is, and so forth and so on. And, you know, I try to elaborate that as much as I can in my work so that we can at least make a start on understanding this again.
But is not the power, though, in us, though, in the we, in the us as a collective consciousness?
No, not the way I see it at all. I know that those have become very talismanic words. In fact, to me, the word we is almost the supreme talismanic word of the age. When I study the methodology, let's just put it this way, when I actually go in and study the methodology of any of the people that I consider perfidious, the people who are the controllers, I keep seeing that. I keep seeing this hallmark. It's almost like it's not me inventing it. They are themselves the greatest champions of this collectivism and this ubiquitous we. And therefore, I'm wondering then how, when I hear people parroting it, even well-meaning people in the New Age movement and religion, and they continually espouse this we-ness and this ourness and this collective action. See, to me, that is completely null and void. It has no significance. It has no spiritual currency at all in my reading of this whole problem.
Michael, let's take a quick break right there. TruthFrequencyRadio.com. We'll see you on the other side, ladies and gentlemen.
Try to realize the truth.
What truth?
There is no spoon. There is no spoon. There is no spoon. There is no spoon.
And welcome back to Truth Frequency. And we are speaking with our amazing guest, Michael Tesarian. Welcome to all of the AM and FM affiliates picking up only the second hour. And Michael, since we have just a short segment here, do you mind if we take a caller?
No, go ahead.
Excellent. David in Minnesota, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hey, I just called my computer broke. I called in to listen, but what are you guys talking about? I usually have an opinion about almost everything.
We're talking about mind control.
Oh, mind control? Well, we know that the population of the United States is, of course, under mass mind control. That the mass media keeps them under mass mind control.
Absolutely. And,
if they watch it, yes.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we appreciate that, David, and we'll let you listen back on the line. Somebody mismarked this, but it's okay. Michael, let me ask you this. What are you working on here in the next 3 minutes that we have in this segment?
Oh, doing a lot of different projects. I'm putting the final touches to at least 3 or 4 DVDs. I have a new book planned to come out during the March or April. So, you know, I've got 16, 17 websites to be maintaining. There's talks, lots of different interesting things. It's just, you know, keeps me busy. There's a lot of things going on. The Architects 2 project, of course, you know, we're continuing to film that. And awesome. My Tree of Life and Disciples of the Mysterium. This is, again, in fact, when we were talking before the break about the article on the self where I explained this, is now I remember it was actually the Disciples of the Mysterium article that I did, and then we did a couple of interviews on that. And that's where I go in much more deeply to how to understand this concept of the self and how it basically ties into the state of decay that we see in the world. So that's been an interesting project that I've been working on all year.
Where can people find your work?
Just go to michaeltesarian.com, click through to the next page, and you'll see a link for articles. And you can see that article if they want to hear the previous interviews I've done on it. Just simply go to YouTube/unslavedfilms. And that's where all my interviews are. These Disciples of the Mysterium interviews are there. They're one of a kind, by the way. That's the first time ever that philosophy and conspiracy have been tied together in this particular way. So it was really, really something great for me, a really good feeling to be able to have a good response. Basically, I was very apprehensive of how that would go over, and yet it was an overwhelming response of yes, we get it. So that was really, really great. And that was this year. And there's a couple of interviews up there. It's youtube.com/unslavedfilms. And that'll take you to my account there.
If there was one piece of work that was yours, somebody who's never heard of Michael Tesarian before, which one would you point him towards?
Architects of Control, I think, is very good for, say, the beginner. That's something we did last year, and we had enormous feedback on it. It's a DVD on many of the points we're talking about. It started off as an homage to Jim Keith, but then grew out into a much more elaborate look at mind control, touching on 2012, which, of course, is coming up right now. And my take on 2012 is you know, 180 degrees different than everyone else speaking on that subject, in the sense that I'm not looking at it as any kind of, you know, spiritual transcendence and all of that. I'm looking at it as being a death of what we know to be the human. Very much that after that particular date, we enter into the post-human, trans-human world, where most of the idioms that we've all talked about this before, about the idea that people who are not coming to selfhood, people who are not doing their spiritual homework, people who are getting very lost in these collectives, are playing right into the hands of Big Brother, who's ready to bring down the curtain on, you know, humanity 1.0. They're ready to move into 2.0 right now, and that's very much sort of...
And let's pick it up from there when we get back. TruthFrequencyRadio.com, Architects of... Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, Truth Frequency Radio and our great guest, Michael Tesarian. And now we have a couple of long segments so we can get back into the meat and potatoes of the broadcast. Michael, do you just want to pick it up, or we have some more leading questions if you'd like?
Well, I was just looking over my Mysterium article, and I want to hit you with 3 short quotes that basically do better than I could do to sum the whole situation up. The first one, we were talking earlier about philosophers, so here's one from Plato. And he says that states are as men. They grow out of human characters. Thomas Paine, the great freedom fighter, in his Rights of Man, he says, to understand the nature and quantity of government proper for man, it is necessary to attend to his character. Again, emphasizing that what the self is, the complexion of a person's selfhood, will determine all of the external phenomena that he subsequently goes on to create. And then he also went on to say, the more perfect civilization is, the less occasion it has for government. And that's a really classic one there. Perfect civilization is, the less occasion it has for government. Look how important that statement is. First of all, Paine is saying it's the self that is the basis of everything that man creates, including his social conventions and his governments. And then he goes on to say, if you've got too much government, then you've got a pathogenic problem there, because the more perfect a civilization is, the less need it has for these controllers, for the carrot and the stick, and the draconian type of structures and instincts that come with that. These people, as I said, these great philosophers were under no doubt about it. From Plato up until even the modern age, the self was understood to be where it's at when it comes to looking again in the external world. You look to the external world, it's a manifestation, reflection of man's consciousness.
So the controllers really have us in a pickle, don't they? They have rid us of our selfhood so that they can be, so they can stand in as our self and trick us into thinking that whatever happens to the collective is actually happening to us too.
Yes, and that will only work if they fool us into identifying so deeply with the collective. Like I said, it's not that we shouldn't have collectivism to a degree with a small c, but what has happened is that these people have manipulated a natural instinct within man to live together, to harmonize together, to share, to talk, to develop, to evolve together, to share skills and insights, a normal interactivity, which is not found in the world today. We have a pathological, pathological clustering of non-selves all galvanizing together with talismanic words like oneness and we-ness and collectivism and selfhood and individuality and independence. And when you probe deeply, you find that these words are not concrete. They're about as flabby as the Pillsbury boy. They have no substance anymore. And see, to carry on with what you were alluding to there, it doesn't work. None of this works. None of this experiment works. And this is also key to the solution. Until people realize that the self that they imagine that they have is a pseudo-self, just like we were speaking at the beginning of the show. As long as that pseudo-self is taken irrationally for the real self, no progress is going to be made. So the schools, the institutions, the colleges, the universities, the consensus, the television, all of the forms of control are to do precisely that. Media gives you images of perfect heroic males, perfectly heroic females. These are what known in the trade as idealized images. In psychology, they call them idealized images, impossible ideals that the kids are meant to identify with and live up to. Not that all of the traits are bad. Of course, fiction in a classical way gives us perfect, very good models and by which to base our lives on. But what Hollywood does is it tweaks it. It sterilizes these characters, makes them very black and white, white cap, black cap type of thing. And then we are meant to identify with these. When you identify with those pseudo selves, you're being pulled out from the real self. You're not good enough unless you're like X, Y, and Z, you see. So the media does it this way. Education does it another way, and so forth and so on. But what is it doing? It's crafting for you the sort of mind-forged manacles, like this sort of robot, this mold of the pseudo self, and trying to make it fit. And a lot of people get accustomed to it, acculturated to those molds that are not true selves, start animating those molds, then they get a lot of approval from the world going, well done. It's like David Icke says, don't step outside that little square. You don't want to step outside that square. And if you try to go outside it, the guard dogs bark you back inside that little consensus. That's the whole point. Then we start winning certain approvals, because this, again, doesn't work without a certain amount of carrot. But none of this has to do with the real reason why people are on this planet. And so in my work, there was always a need to connect the state of decay, the world architecture of control, back to consciousness, which has not been done to any level of a degree, even though there's been many people who've talked about mind control, but they've talked about mind control in that more technical way of what was happening in Russia during the Pavlovian times and that kind of thing, and MKUltra, almost like it's a sort of separate phenomena, and boy, oh boy, if we just didn't have that, we'd all be fine. Well, I don't accept that, because we've got lots of other devices of mind control, namely religion, and how we even think of God. I'm not saying this is not an argument as to whether God exists or not. That's a separate question. But I'm saying the ideas we have about the God that we imagine exists or has been handed to us by religions, well, we are into heavy-duty mind control there, with another institution of criminals behind it. So everywhere we look, we see this. John Taylor Gatto has gone into it when he talks about education. R.D. Lang has talked about it when he went into how the psychiatric institutions are set up. The media, and so forth and so on. We're surrounded by pathological, completely psychopathic corporations. And there's a feedback loop, because those corporations are made by psychopathic men. They don't just arise on their own. So there's a feedback loop between the psychopathic pseudo-self, the pseudo-human being, and then these giant leviathans that take on the that take on a psychotic nature, and then it goes on forever. And that ball has been rolling now for the last since the Industrial Revolution, and our ways of life, our connection to nature, which is fundamental, has been changing since the Industrial Revolution. And this revolution we're going to have now, which 2012 is some sort of a marker of, is one enormous gate closing on the process that has been actually going on, arguably from the Industrial Revolution. We're now going to enter into a new concept of manhood, a new concept of womanhood, a new concept of childhood, and a new concept of how we view this world, because the controllers have decided that, yep, people, we've managed to get them this far, and they have been artificialized, and they have been thinned out in their consciousness. They are up to the level of sadomasochism that we're happy with, you know, and the next will be easy. These individuals have lost all sense of freedom. They're itching for freedom from freedom, and therefore they become compliant to an extraordinary degree. And this has gone on, and it's ubiquitous throughout the world.
And they've done a really good job of making it look like you're psychotic if you don't want to go along with all of this.
They've reversed the whole story exactly as you say. They've mirrored it to make these models of imperfection appear to be the perfection. And Buckminster Fuller, great scientist, other people have said it, the divide to conquer, the world's power structure, he said, have always divided to conquer. Yeah, but dividing to conquer happens first with consciousness, because you don't need to leave the armchair or the penthouse if you can go to the nucleus and cause incredible upheaval and fragmentation there. The rest will follow. You don't have to go and manage it out in the streets. If you can divide a human being within themselves, I even believe, as you well know from my Atlantis work, that this was even done on a biological level. You asked earlier which one of my books might be a good thing to recommend. The Atlantis book might be a good place to start, because this is the earliest. I go into the earliest, what I believe is the earliest, rendition of this divide to conquer policy, which actually happened in ancient times on a biological level, which then had a concomitant on a psychic level, and then again on a consciousness level, you see. So if the man himself is divided, and there's great evidence to show that this is in fact take place, that is why then we perceive a universe of black and white, male and female, up and down, inside and outside, good and bad, God and devil, all the other dualities that hardly any philosopher has been able to even explain how those come into existence. But we do know they're there. They arise because of the schizoid nature of the human consciousness. And this is played right into the hands of the modern controllers, who are expert in knowing how to manipulate that.
Wow. So it's no wonder that we've got so many quote-unquote crazy people running around.
People who are crazy because they are trying to sustain something that is ultimately unsustainable. The more life force and energy that you give to this pseudo-self, it is not workable. It is simply not going to happen. And people force it to happen. Then they wonder why their relationships break down. Then they wonder why the family unit is in a state of chaos. Then they wonder why even the most simplest mysteries remain impenetrable. That's when they try to do some seeking, even when they enter into these fields. It seems like a million new questions pop up, and no real solutions are ever given. Even philosophers and scientists concede this fact, that it seems to be an endless labyrinth where the moment that you probe into one thing, 100 new questions arise. Yeah, because you haven't been right asking the right answer, or the tool by which you're analyzing the universe and the meaning of life, meaning your consciousness, that's the ultimate tool, is itself refracted, is itself unclear, is itself unfocused. I call them disciples of the mysterium. The mysterium being all the things that you create to substitute for reality, be it God, be it other people, be it a cause, be it science, be it a false image of oneself, be it an idea of what's going to happen in the afterlife. I don't care, being it a false understanding of nature, which I think is fundamental, because if anyone wants to understand my work and my take on all of this, they have to understand that just like a true shaman does, I do not see a single ounce of difference between what I refer to as the self and nature. To me, those are just two words for the same thing. I have to insist upon that. So any move to divorce oneself from oneself is instantaneously a divorce from nature, and vice versa. The man who divorces himself from nature, as you can see most of us have done by living in these obscene cities, likewise is, without him even knowing it, disowning and divorcing himself from self. Because self and nature are not arguably, but provably the same thing. This is what Carl Jung and other people have discovered. It's what the mystics have been saying for centuries, for millennia. So if you divorce yourself from nature and live in this artificialdom, you are actually, by the same token, a selfless person. And if you psychologically play the game of the persona, look for the cues and affectations, have chronic dependency on the approval of other people, you are actually divorcing yourself from nature, which is the divine intelligence, which is the highest intelligence that is the all heal. It's nature that's going to show us the right way when we finally discover we haven't found the right way. But the man who has become completely out of sync with nature, i.e. his own selfhood, because there's no difference in my reading of the two, it's just another misconception, that person is in dire jeopardy and, as you say, walks around insane or unsane.
Wow. Yeah, that completely makes sense. It's like showing up for a job interview without any clothes on.
Yeah.
You know,
then we have a Leviathan which says, don't worry, it's fixable. Come and suck these drugs. It's just a mechanical failure of the simulacra self that we've given you. We'll patch it up. We even have drugs now that will remove all of those disturbing and irritating emotions.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to feel sad anymore, and you can take a pill to sleep. You can take a pill to wake up. You can take a pill to not be anxious. You can take a pill to make you happier.
But when things are bad, you should feel bad.
I agree. And when something's corrupt and unjust, you should face it. People go, oh, Michael, you're so negative. You look at the negative side. Avoiding the negative that causes the negative. There's your answer. By avoiding that which you think is negative, the negative and the evil is created. The man who faces it, faces the shadow, he dissolves it. How come people have forgotten these laws? Today they're going to put implants in your brain and so forth and so on, where you will just be happy all the time. You won't exist, but you'll be perfectly happy. You'll be perfectly contented. They're going to plug you into all these virtual realities that are going to completely satiate all your lower desires, even give you pseudo-heavenly experiences and so on. We've seen this predicted in many movies. We know the technology is arriving to do this, to keep you satiated and under control, because people are going to go for it themselves. They're so sick and tired of their emotions. Those emotions have become so toxic, you see, so unsane, that this is the backlash. You can't suppress the soul and you can't suppress the self without an enormous fallout. This has been predicted by Jung and others. And this should make sense even to Christians. You have Origen, the church father, saying, for yourself is even a little world within you, is the sun and the moon and also the stars. You have umpteen references within religion showing you that it's within you as the kingdom of God. There's nothing that I'm saying is in any way preposterous. You know, we have the philosopher Jacob Burckhardt who said, in history, the way of annihilation is invariably prepared by inward degeneration. Like we were saying earlier, divide the mind, degenerate the mind, insert negative memes, have years of science and behaviorism that makes the nature and the world and the cosmos around you appear to just be some sort of machinery. And people will believe that and suck it in and never even question it. Have years and years and years of religion that forces you to think of yourself as a microscopic, sinning non-entity in relationship to an all-powerful, omnipotent, and wrathful God. You know, so we have actual, so it goes back to your question, how does one come back to the self? You start to notice the perfidious, corrupt, unsustainable lie mechanism that surrounds you. It's not easy, nobody ever said it was, but it is a holy work, a sacred science that needs to be done, in which you, like a Sherlock Holmes, you start to deduce what is false, what doesn't hold up to deep reason, hold everything up to the light of reason. That's the God within us, is the reason that we've been given that separates us from every other species on this planet. And through the reason, we've been able to create magnificent things that distinguish the human race. But the slave masters are not interested in us using our reason, you see. Not to mention other capacities that we have that most people don't even know exist. Intuition and so on.
Where does the pineal gland play into all of this? And why is there so much effort to, from what I can gather, calcify it?
Well, it's not just one gland. Our entire bodies are under attack. The immune system is not what people think it is. The immune system is actually a spiritual defense mechanism that we have to ward off various forms of pathogens. The pineal gland and these areas are wide awake in children, for instance, and children being hypersensitive, bringing in with them an incredible gnosis, an incredible live, vivid understanding and intelligence. And from the moment that they're born, before they even leave the intimate family dynamic, you basically have these two tyrants that we laughingly call parents. They couldn't parent a thing if it, half the parents of the world couldn't parent anything if they tried.
Very true.
That is true.
These people are nothing but puppets, glove puppets for the system, dominating the child and using the legal precedence that they are some sort of, you know, control. They have control over this slave. and using it and manipulating it to fill the child full of their own wants and their own needs and their own frustrations and so on, basically countermanding the natural intelligence of the child. To most parents, the child is not there to teach them anything. It's there to be a crutch. It's there to entertain them like some sort of toy. And then as soon as the child grows up and develops its independent consciousness, there's a whole breakdown in relationship. Because now the child has become an individual.
That completely makes sense.
That reminds me of a Pink Floyd song. Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb?
That's right.
Yes.
Yep.
We just went and saw Pink Floyd do The Wall. Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
They're a great band. They're one of the bands like that have been trying to point this out for years. I said one time in Bath at the conference, I didn't actually do a talk. I did a short intro. And in that intro, I said, I've always had this question. How come it is with all the great music, not just rock music, but other kinds, all the great movies, the great literature, how is it people still don't change? Because these guys have gone to the nth degree to point out some of these mechanisms of control. The wall is nothing but a metaphor in so many elaborate ways of the various control, the teachers, the lawyers, the judges, and the doctors. You know, he points these out, and the parents. Mm-hmm. And he points this out about these ambassadors of control, these architects of control. And when we try to fix it, I went into this in the Origins of Evil talk that I did, one of the responses in an unhealthy way is to rebel. See, the rebellion is what most people think is, okay, I don't like the system, I'm going to rebel against it. But the rebellion is just the flip side of the coin of conformity.
That's
rebelling against what you don't like often doesn't bring that thing down. It's probably a healthy stage in the early stages, but unfortunately, there seems to be another phenomena that we need to understand, and that is the wall that you build to keep that out eventually starts keeping you in.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the kinds of reaction against what we're talking about that we've seen throughout the years has been somewhat misgiven. I know it's been well-meaning, but it hasn't been based on this rational, spiritual, highly critical, judgmental capacity to see the lie for what it really is. It's just a sort of a Neanderthal-like rebellion against what you think you don't like. This is often why you see that those who rebel become a next generation of tyrants, because they haven't really thought out what is the origins of tyranny. How does my mind is the tyrant. I am living a pseudo-self. I have the right to exchange one fake costume for another, and that's what we've seen down through the histories during the 60s and so on, and even the New Age movement. People are just exchanging one straitjacket for another. That doesn't mean freedom, that just is changing the decoration.
It's like, I know I'm mad at someone, I just don't know who.
That's right. Moving the furniture around on the Titanic.
Yeah, exactly. You were partly inspired by an event that took place in a coffee shop that reminded you of The Wall by Pink Floyd. Can you tell our listeners about that encounter and why that seemed to really grab your attention?
Well, all my life I've been studying children and also teaching kids, and I've always found that very rewarding because I know how to get into that ancestral consciousness of theirs. There's various techniques one can use. It'd be too elaborate to get into, part of it is using symbolism as opposed to words. This works a lot, and that incident that happened in Seattle was just a sort of, just drove it home how unbelievable this parent-child dynamic was and how insidious it can be. In which this particular father, who happened to be extremely self-absorbed and completely unconscious of his obviously spiritually, gifted child, which it just pointed, one can't judge him and say the whole system, but this sort of vignette that happened, this kid was looking out at the rain and looking out at the crows and was just in this completely, what I would call, spiritual state. I hate to use the word trance because it has negative connotations to it, but it was some sort of mystical almost state, which is you see a lot of children in, these semi-aware ones who before they're, 7 years of old, because they say by 7 or 8, you've lost it completely. Well, somehow this kid had not lost this particular idiosyncrasy of his own psyche. It was very vivid there. And this father was just acting like a complete and utter tyrant. And when the kid didn't respond, the actual father had been just yapping away a mile a minute to this barista who could care less. But he was unraveling his life story or whatever. When his coffee got made, he turned to his kid and very abruptly just said, time to go. And then when the kid didn't hear, he went right over to the front of his kid's face and snapped his fingers like a sergeant major, really loud, go, time to go. So who couldn't think of that line on the wall? You know, time to go, time to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to go, but we'll be right back with Michael Tesarian, TruthFrequencyRadio.com. We'll see you in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Vaig dins els canals en el peu de Santanya pareix que sent picarols suau si es mou sa manada.
And welcome back to Truth Frequency. This is the co-host, Cherie, and with me, as always, is the very handsome Chris Geo, and we're talking to Michael Tesarian about his work and his theories about how we can get in touch with our inner self, our true self. And Michael, I had a question for you. We've had about 2 or 3 generations of people who are basically mind controlled. What advice do you have for parents out there who have kids and don't want to repeat the same adversarial behavior that they had with their own parents with their child?
Well, again, it's about trying to bring out what is unique in the child. And that takes, again, a deconstructive model. And letting the child have a lot of exposure to nature, a lot of exposure to great art, to great music, things of the right brain, not always imposing upon them this vision of what they're going to be tomorrow when they grow up to be young adults acculturated to the system, you see. That's an important aspect of it. Helping them to strengthen their critical ability and judgment, as opposed to make them politically correct zombies in which you're not able to speak up and say what you want. Obviously not to belligerently shut them down and quieten them up when you see what you might call aberrant behavior. I think what's the most important thing today is to realize that this so-called attention deficit and all of these things is that form of, shall I say, schizophrenia, which is healthy because the kids are rebelling against what they subconsciously see as a complete lie that's suppressing their inner self. And the parent has to monitor themselves to understand how they may be working unconsciously as agents of that tyranny. That's very, very important. And one, the parents that I've seen who are successful at doing that are awakened. They do this. They do read. They do study this material. And they try to protect the child's innocence. And one of the most important things also, which is important across the board, because you see, anything I would say that works for children is the same thing I would say that works for the whole human race. You can't really distinguish one from the other. That also leads you to nothing but problems. Because when you're dealing with consciousness, you're just dealing with consciousness. It doesn't matter if it's a male or female, black or white or whoever. This is the key to my message. And one of the most important things we need to do as a species, and one that will certainly work in children, is to stop making it possible for children or anyone else to be chronically dependent on the approval of other people. This is one of the things. This is one of the golden roads, one of the royal roads to selfhood, which is to make sure that the individual is able to speak their mind and be independent and not become chronically dependent on the psychological approval of others. I don't mean not rely on the postman to deliver your mail, you know, and the milkman and the banker and all these things are needed functionally. But what we have done, as I said, we've immersed ourselves. We've used these normal interactivities, these mercurial interactivities with people. We've used it for psychological entanglement. And one of the worst of these, one of the worst spawn of that is this desire for constant approval, so that a person becomes totally neurotic. In women, you see bulimia and anorexia and all sorts of other physiological conditions. In men, you might see chronic aggression and competitiveness. Because you see, what the downside is that when you are conditioned to seek approval, not just from auntie and uncle and mommy and daddy and neighbors and teachers and all the rest of them, each person's doing this one to the other. So it becomes a viral problem. The one you're seeking from approval from is seeking approval from you. So it's an unspoken negative viral thing going around. But the trouble is that we often don't get the approval that we seek so neurotically from other people. And then when you don't receive it, then you have the problem fallout. There's a lot of stages to this process. I went into this in great detail in my talk on The Outsider. Those are interviews, again, that are on Slave Films. People can go and check those out. I went into it in greater detail. but these are basically fruits of the tree of inauthentic life. And one of the most important ones, not only there's guilt or shame, there's lots of features to this. One of the most important one is the seeking for chronic approval, then not getting the approval, and then having fallout, which turns out to be chronic self-sadism. Somebody else would call it masochism, in which the person is then constantly beating themselves up in millions of ways and hundreds of ways on a daily basis because they didn't get that approval from others. It's very nice to have approval from others when you deserve it and when you can get it, but we shouldn't be so compulsively conditioned to depend on it that when we don't get it, we become fragmented and disturbed and frustrated and neurotic. This is very, very a big problem. And it, of course, it's happening in the young all the time, where they're constantly on this treadmill of seeking this approval until finally, again, the mind rebels because it's not getting it, and then it lashes out. Women will interject it normally, and therefore they'll have all these physiological disorders. Men will have those too, but then they also tend to act it out in violent and compulsive and sadistic ways. Because if you're sadistic towards the self, it's only one step away of being sadistic towards animals, sadistic towards other human beings. And then that's what creates a tyrant. That's what creates a boss. That's what creates the new dictator in town, be he a petty bully in the schoolyard or some corporate leader or governor of the state or even mega politician. These people are deeply, deeply toxic.
Well, I think
and also another important feature is to help the children. This is very much what Krishnamurti did, is allow them to become profoundly negative in the purest philosophical sense. Let them break it down. Let them question. You know, Vernon Howard, the great American philosopher, said, human sickness is so severe that few can bear to look at it. But those who do look at it will become well. There's a direct equation between being able to negate and break something down and question it and criticize it and use your faculty for which it is useful, not just as a slave for the system. They don't mind if you bring those talents into something like science so you can help Big Brother in its campaign for world slavery. Then they don't mind you being nicely and critical and judgmental when you got a PhD and a big budget behind you. But if you're going to use it for the development of your own soul, I'm sorry, the signpost says taboo, can't do that, prohibited.
That's right? True.
So it's a double standards. And we have to show, once the child's mind, and I'm already telling you that the child mind is pretty much already good to go before it's been stifled. Children are very good at this, what I'm talking about. When they're able to deconstruct, when they're able to poke things and find out, this is inconsistent, this doesn't work.
The emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. Once you ingratiate that, then you're well on your way to a much, much more healthy situation. But it starts in the family dynamic. I'll agree with you on that. It does start in the microcosm of the family, and it goes from there. My family dynamic was always based on that. Totally being criticized. You know, you go out on a Sunday to visit various cousins and various aunts and uncles, and always telling them, take that hair out of your eyes. You know, why are you wearing that Motorhead T-shirt? Blah blah blah. You know, it might be said somewhat in fun or sort of well-meaningly, but what they're doing is they're suppressing you. They're trying to change your identity to do what? Make them like you. You be you. You're fine with the way you are. I'm fine the way I am. What does it bloody matter, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to get into the meta child after the break, but we've got about 2 minutes. So let me go to this caller from Pennsylvania. He's been holding for the bulk of the broadcast. So Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Is this me?
Yes. You're on the air. 412.
I've got some questions about how language works and the philosophy behind language. I've been noticing a lot of the 4G networks and the 7-4 synchronicities that are going on a lot. In today's world, you got 7-4, which would be G and D, which is God. But 7-4 also gives you 7-22, and 22 divided by 7 is 3.14, which is pi.
Yeah. Now, what's the name of the caller?
We're not sure about his name. He's in Pennsylvania.
Well, he's Brandon. I'm just kind of curious. Do you also understand the philosophy of how pi relates in the language?
Oh, absolutely. And I was hoping to get time. Chris, you asked me earlier some of the projects I'm working on. I'm hoping to work on a little vlog called Liber Numerica, which goes into this numbers, and 74 and its reverse, 47, are very, very important power numbers that are encoded into the pyramid and various things. I wonder if Brandon there has actually heard of the author Bonnie Gaunt.
No, I haven't.
If you go online on Amazon and look up the name Bonnie Gaunt, B-O-N-N-I-E Gaunt. Yeah. She has books that are loaded with 47 and 74 symbolism, so I highly recommend her work. Her work is fundamentally brilliant for anyone into sacred geometry, sacred numerology, and so on, but she spends a lot of time going into that number, so she could say a lot more about it than I can. I'd have to refer to my notes and get into that mind space. But certainly, when you're talking about language, we're into one of the most powerful areas of mind control imaginable. Because we...
Right, because in the mind is where the language is, and the language is where you think, and you think in a certain language. So if you had an archetype in the language, you could control the mind through language.
Well, they're doing it through what I call talismanic terms, talismanic words. I've spoken that in multiple talks that I've done and other works. We spoke about it a little earlier on the show. Talismanic words, if you go to YouTube into my Unslaved films, you'll see a whole bunch of presentations on that, the talismanic words, the misuse of language, the seeding of it, the tweaking and the contortion and reconfiguration of words and the meanings that they have.
Stay right there, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on the other side, truthfrequencyradio.com. We're going to do one more segment with Michael Tesorian, michaeltesorian.com, architectsofcontrol.com is his website, truthfrequencyradio.com is ours. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, truthfrequencyradio.com, and we are speaking with Michael Tesorian. And Michael, would you like to pick it up with the numerology, or do you want to get into the Meta Child a little bit?
Well, again, I would just say that, this is important study even for children as well. I mean, I have a whole divination course that I teach because I so much believe in these sacred sciences and sacred arts, and there's no reason why children themselves shouldn't be involved in the tarot and astrology. You were asking about, you know, some more... that will help children. I'm pretty much convinced that not only should kids be allowed to work with their hands, both in painting or pottery or gardening, they should be exposed to animals as much as possible. We mentioned nature, but I included in that also being exposed to animals and their intelligence. And I would also highly emphasize instruments, musical instruments. If I had my way, every child would at least dabble in it, so at least if the ones who are really not interested in it, they could obviously do something else or technical or whatever. But if they have any type of penchant for music, should be exposed to world music, as we said, classical music, great music, all kinds of music, and also be exposed to instruments, because it's a great way to express oneself. Because in that situation, when parents today expose their children to these things, they invariably send them to classical lessons. And again, we're back into the whole formal thing of this is how you do it. And this is the sort of a program way of approaching these things. But in the early stage, and that's because the parent is, again, trying to surrogately live through that child, because he's not going to be Segovia or something, or Eric Clapton or whoever, or Eddie Van Halen, right? No, just let the child be himself for just 5 minutes, please. And, you know, he'll go on to be great. He'll be the next Joe Satriani. But can you just let the child's right brain operate here? And this is the very, very kind of feedback that the Steve Vais and the Satrianis and the Frank Zappas give you. It's just, look, I got into it out of love. It was a thing to express myself, either through art or collage or pottery or gardening or working with animals. You see, there's all these ways that are slowly being forgotten. And even in the families, which, as I say, that do include it, they tend to do it in a very formulaic, fixed pattern style, which again is not particularly healthy, you know, because again, I think it's more coming from the parents' vision of who their child's going to be, as opposed to letting the child just discover himself or herself through those particular age-old instruments and accoutrements.
What about teaching your children symbolism? What different symbols mean?
Well, that's number one, and that's why I said I had the greatest results. Because remember, not every child likes music, not every child likes gardening and all. But I found that one universal sort of interest that covers almost every child without fail is this symbolism. Because symbolism is a sort of a ubiquitous general subject that an individual child will find use for regardless of what they later on want to specialize in. You know, in the class that I actually taught on symbolism, one of the kids, would the way he was talking, he was going to make the next Stephen King. I could tell he was a black kid. And he came from a totally working-class family, very much a ghetto thing, you know. And instead of getting into the gangs, this kid had an imagination you could not believe. And I'm telling you, if he had continued on with some of the stories that he was telling about his ideas, that kid could have been the next Clive Barker. I mean, already he wouldn't have had a problem about career or anything like that because he had an incredibly vivid imagination. And this is just one example I'm telling you. There was lots of other kids who had exactly the same kind of mentality. And when you teach them symbolism, that becomes applicable in lots of other areas. They go into design, they go into movies, they go into technology, they go into computers, they go into music. Whatever field of people go into, you're going to come up against those universals, number, symbolism, sound, shape, these kinds of things. So yeah, absolutely. Even advertising, people go into advertising. You know, it's very important for that, movie making, you name it. There's very a lot cool. of fields in which the symbolism will be very, very needed because these are, again, bringing out the personal characteristics of the child. They're allowing the child to sort of inhabit those particular interests. You see, those interests bring out the true nature of the child.
Yeah, instead of making them use the rest of the world as some sort of security blanket, instead they're focusing on their true self, and they don't need the rest of the world's approval as a security blanket.
Yeah, remember we were talking earlier about the way the Big Brother co-opts the idea that the brain needs stimulus and then they overdo it?
Mm-hmm.
When the person has become addicted to the overstimulation of the world and the gadgetry of the world, not that the individual gadgets are wrong, but this compulsive obsessiveness with these gadgets, then that shuts down this organic, you know, selfhood and this sort of expression within. When you bring up the child to do what we're talking about, the child is far less turned on by that external stimuli. In other words, in psychological terms, they become less outer-directed, more inner-directed. So that even when the world throws all of this external miasma at the child, it resists it. This is how my brother, for instance, brings up his child. And a lot of people that you know, go to Steiner School and various decent private schools are sort of, in a way, slightly based on this. And it's a very healthy thing because, you see, you can't police every moment of the child's life, least of all through teenage years. So you have to do the work young. And when you do the right work young, you can leave it. Once you have the child so interested in things that it is creating for itself, so absorbed, even when you turn that TV on and you throw all the stimuli of the world at the child has its own natural defenses. They not only say, that's bunk, I don't want to watch that, I don't want to listen to that, I'd rather go off and do something else. But the parent who's providing none of these things or making the things that are provided feel insipid and dictatorial, that child will want escape. And that's mm-hmm. when they become in the hands of Big Brother, who's providing all of those escapes. But it is the parent who is meant to help develop the critical apparatus of the child, turn the kid on to other things that are far more interesting. Guess what? A thing called a book. Wow, a book. No way. Right? You know, reading or whatever it might be, or even creative writing or all of these, you know, things that have become so unpopular right now. If the child's, I don't care what it is, you see, I'm not there to dictate what it is, but when the child's natural inclinations are discovered and those are supported, chances are that the child is not going to allow itself to be infected by all the garbage of the world because it can't see it as garbage. And therefore, the job is done. The parent doesn't have to be there, you know, in reins to micromanage every single little thing of the child, which is a very big difference that you see with parents, how they treat their children in Europe as opposed to how parents treat their children in America. One of the most important differences that I've seen, and there's a many, is that the American parent has got the child on a very short leash. The kid cannot even move 5 feet away without this panic being projected at it by the mother, even in a secure environment like a bookstore or a mall or somewhere like that. There's so much fear and trepidation and paranoia from the parents, whereas in Europe, the kid can just roam around, even walk around on their own in the streets, go and climb the frames that are made out of iron without thinking, oh my God, he's going to fall and break his skull, ride the seesaws. And so what happens is that the parent who projects trust onto the child, I trust you to do the right thing. I know you're going to not say it in words, which American families are great at, using the words. Yeah, that doesn't mean anything. You get to send the energy of perfect trust to your child. And if you do that, it's not going to have those accidents. And even if it does, it's going to feel secure, you see, and protected, and that this was a natural even though it was painful, it's perfectly natural. It thickens the skin. This happens. But by protecting the kid by this sort of pseudo-false protectiveness, which is basically disguised paranoia, you make the child a neurotic child. So it's so fearful to experience the world. It's so fearful to interact with other people. Everything's a threat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Michael, we've got about 2 minutes left. What would you leave the audience with this evening?
Well, I would just say try to observe some of the stuff that we've been talking about look at the world around you and notice the barbed wire fences. Start to get in touch with the prohibitions that are all ubiquitous around you, be it street signs, be it billboards, be it the words that other people speak, be it your own consciousness. Do exercises like I just recommended, which is examine your own mind to see how much the lives of other people dominate your consciousness. Like I say, I emphasize again, don't judge it. Don't beat yourself up about it. Just observe it like a scientist. And you'll notice something. Something amazing will come out of that sense of discovery. Look at the artificiality that's around you. Look at the consensus trance that's around you. Look how you're being herded. And then start to understand what kind of consciousness, you see, would do that. The toxic consciousness. And you don't want to be infected by their virus. And to not be infected by any virus, be it even physiological, biological, you have to strengthen your own immune system. So my work in particular is merely about that, is to offer some sort of holistic remedies, if you will, to help people strengthen that immunity, which basically is the selfhood, which is your critical ability, your judgment, your spirit of rebellion. Until those things are installed within the psyche, you can do all the political and economic change that you want, and it will have no power at all, because your controllers are psychologically empowered far, far more. They know about the nature and the dynamics of consciousness. And the person who walks into that field with all the well-meaningness and humanity and compassion and love, and they're missing the ingredient of intelligence, of knowledge, of know thyself. That is the key thing. And that's a journey, and it should be a beautiful adventure, not a task, not a chore. That's the main thing that I would recommend.
I completely agree. Michael Tsarian, we really appreciate it. You're always welcome on the broadcast, and we really appreciate you being gracious with your time every time.
Oh, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You have
good
a great
luck to the show.
Thank you, sir. You have a great evening. Ladies and gentlemen, tune in every Saturday, 10 o'clock Central, truthfrequencyradio.com here on Oracle Broadcasting. We'll see you next week. Another amazing show. Archive will be available for free download in a couple of hours. So if you missed the beginning of the show, download it. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.